Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Crazy Money. This is your host, Paul, reminding you that today is a great day to be alive. Folks, if you've ever wanted to see or hear me role play as a gaslighting narcissist, this is the episode for you. My guest this week is Dr. Ramani Durvasula. She's a clinical psychologist and an author of the New York Times bestseller, It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic Behavior. In this insight-rich conversation, Dr. Ramani explains the traits and behaviors of narcissistic individuals, how they hijack our well-being, and the motivations behind their attention-seeking behavior. You might just recognize this as consistent with somebody in your life. Not me, though, because she relieves me of the sneaking suspicion that I might be in the wrong place on the narcissism continuum. Speaking of which, we discuss how narcissism is more of a continuum than it is a binary diagnosis. We talk about gender and narcissism. That's right. Even though your favorite narcissists are men, ladies is narcissists too, folks. We talk about the different kinds of narcissism. It's like a rainbow of flavors of narcissism. There's the grandiose narcissist, the malignant narcissist, the neglectful one. Oh, and my favorite, the self-righteous narcissist, whom you can find virtue signaling on a social media platform near you. Speaking of which, we talk about how social media has amplified narcissistic behavior. We talk about gaslighting and other tools narcissists use to sow self-doubt in the people who are all around them. We discuss whether Los Angeles or Washington, D.C. is more narcissistic and the different roles that evolve in narcissistic families, the golden child, scapegoat, fixer, etc. And what else? We talk about what are you going to do? What are you going to do if you find yourself trapped in a relationship with a narcissistic person? How do you escape narcissistic abuse? If the behaviors and attitudes that she explains in this conversation sound familiar to you, do yourself a favor and buy this book, because she wrote this as a gift to people who are trapped and need a way out. This, my friends, is Dr. Ramani Durvasula. Finally got it. There we go. Enjoy. So I've got your book here, It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. And it's well annotated. You can see all the questions that
awesome.
I've written.
Awesome. I love seeing that. That's great.
Highlighted in lots of different places. I'm afraid there were times I was reading the book and going like, this sounds awfully familiar to me. Why is that? Before we start talking about narcissism, I just wanted to see, which of these two photos of me do you think shows the world that I'm a very special person, worthy of respect?
Put the picture closer.
No, the pictures aren't the issue. The pictures are my latent or not well-developed narcissism. I don't know. Thank you again for doing this. Tell me a little bit about how you got interested in the topic of narcissism.
Yeah, I got interested in it over a very long period of time. It wasn't taught to us in graduate school or in clinical training. And when I was in my first academic position as a professor, I was working with students who were research assistants at lab sites and clinics around the city. And they'd come back and they really looked like they'd been to battle. And I thought, well, why was it such a difficult day? I asked them and they said, oh my gosh, I saw 10 great people today, but there was one person. And basically they were describing someone who is entitled and difficult and rageful and manipulative. And I thought, this is really interesting. At the time I was doing research in HIV and I thought, nobody's really looking at this issue of personality and personality disorders and understanding, like I said, how people wend their way through health systems and how they take care of themselves. So that started a program of research. And at the same time, I also had a private practice. More and more patients were coming in, describing the same relationships over and over again with family members, certainly with spouses. And I kept telling them the same things. And I thought, why aren't we just educating them on antagonism? We tend to question the person in the relationship and not what's happening to them in the relationship. And then I noticed that nobody in the field of mental health was talking about this. And in fact, that it was almost like bad form to talk about it. And then I put all that in a blender and I thought, okay, something needs to be done. And then I wrote my first book on this topic back in 2016. And that just sort of kept going and going in the world. YouTube and everything gave places to talk about it. I realized, well, my goodness, this is a huge problem that I think actually to this day is relatively ignored by the mental health profession. And that's how I got into it. And then ironically, you would have thought it was my own stuff that got me into it. But really, once I started perfecting these frameworks for clients and institutions and all of that, I was like, well, this has happened a lot in my own life. And that my own denial around what happened to me was actually quite fascinating. And once I recognized how much it freed me up to learn these things about my own life, I thought this is a game changer. And it's a real shame that we're not doing this with everybody who's gone through this, giving them this framework.
So let's talk about your personal orientation toward the topic. You say as a child, mm-hmm. you taught yourself to be invisible. Why is that?
Yeah. I mean, it was how I grew up. And it was very much that there was the narcissistic family system. And it definitely took the old adage of children should be seen and not heard. And in my case, it's children shouldn't be seen or heard, where it was really the narcissistic parent in the system. It was really their way or the highway kind of thing. And you kind of had to go along to get along. And it was very culturally embedded that it was very much that there's a person in a position of authority in the family. Nobody gets to question them. And marriages were very oppressive and all of those things. So it was very much that I would learn to be invisible, not just in my family system. I grew up in the 1970s. I mean, we were the only non-white family in an entirely white town. So to be seen also felt dangerous. And it wasn't a time when teachers would have worked with a kid and helped them feel like they belong. So there was this chronic state of not belonging. And there was never really a place of, other than probably with my mom, a full place of psychological safety where I felt like I could exhale. And so what's the best way to stay safe? Think of the superpower everybody wants. To be able to be invisible. It's not such a good superpower, is it? Because then we start to almost make ourselves not exist in the world. And that sense of invisible equals safe sort of tracked me into adulthood. To this day, it shocks me that I'm a public person. It's a very uncomfortable faith for me.
You're a very confident speaker for somebody who wanted to remain invisible.
Yeah. And it's funny. And I think a lot of that was being a professor. You try keeping stoned undergraduates away for 22 years. You're going to become a really good speaker. Oh,
That's funny. Okay. So let's make sure we're defining our terms and we know what we're talking about here. So we all know Narcissus from mythology, who's this young nymph who fell in love with his own image, or that's what we associated with. But let's define, what is narcissism?
Yeah, it's so unfortunate that's where the myth started. But actually, the myth isn't that far off. You know, the young boy Narcissus was cursed to fall in love with his reflection, and then he ended up killing himself. So this isn't a pretty picture. We always forget that.
Because he couldn't be with the thing with which he was most entranced, which is himself.
Right, he couldn't be with it. And there was just no, it's almost like he couldn't break himself out of that endless loop of, I only love me. I'm entranced by me. I'm entranced by nobody else. There was no capacity for the most central human thing that we need. And we forget how much we need it, which is connection with other people, love, attachment, psychological safety. Yeah. And so that's what we need. But what is narcissism? It's a personality style. It's not a disorder. It's a personality style. And it's characterized by a lack of empathy, entitlement, grandiosity, self-centeredness, being very superficial, vain, self-referential. These are very thin-skinned people. The littlest criticism can spin a narcissistic person completely out, even when it's meaningful feedback. They are people who are very, they need other people. They need what's called narcissistic supply, which is praise and admiration. It can be money. It can be anything that's going to get this person pumped up, right? Propped up so they feel powerful and dominant. Any one of those things by itself is not narcissism. They all have to come together. And when those things all come together, there's lots of dynamics we see, like manipulation, gaslighting, invalidating other people, having contempt for other people, betraying other people, shifting blame onto other people. All of that comes together. And that's where, so those traits lead to behaviors, which show up in relationships, and are not good for other people. But the problem is, I'm giving you all the underbelly traits. The forward-facing traits are charm, charisma, confidence. When a narcissistic person first meets you, they can be very, very compelling.
Yeah.
They, as though you're the only person in the world, they can really sort of drill into you in a conversation. And for a person who may not have traditionally felt seen or heard, this almost feels like magic. And so because the forward-facing traits are so powerful and compelling, and narcissistic people tend to make more money, they tend to be overrepresented in leadership, in entrepreneurship, and in successful entrepreneurship. They are more successful at dating, in relationships. They're more judged to be more attractive. They got a lot going for them.
Yeah. You call that the C-suite, C-based characteristics. And as I'm reading it, I'm like, narcissism isn't a binary thing. It's kind of a continuum, right?
Yeah.
So as I'm reading this, and my friends, my listeners know, I'm being somewhat critical of myself, but I do see elements here. It's like, this is a quote, Narcissistic people need validation and admiration, and this need motivates much of their behavior. They seek status, compliments, excessive recognition, and attention. So like if somebody quit their job to become a stand-up comedian and podcaster, are you worried that they might be displaying some of these needs? Or how do you know when some of that attention seeking is too much or it's okay? Like, where's the safe space on the continuum?
I think the piece is this. If somebody becomes a stand-up comedian and podcaster, my question to them, if I had a person like that in my office, I'd say, what's the driver here? Why are you doing this? And the person says, I love to make people laugh. I love the craft of comedy. I love the puzzle of podcasting. Yeah, the admiration feels good. I'd say, what if you got to do this, but you're not sure anyone's listening? Would you still love the game? And this person says, no, I'm really only doing this for the validation. And if I don't get it, I'm going to get really mad. Narcissism. The person's like, I actually love the game. I love crafting that perfect set or that perfect bit or that perfect opener or having that interview with someone and shaping that into something that'll teach people in the world, which I think a lot of podcasters really went into it because it became a cool way of storytelling, right? That's a very healthy motivation. It's not just about podcast or comedian. It's about the process of those things. And I always say to people, would you like what you do if nobody was listening? And if they, so in other words, you're working in the garden. If no one ever admired your flowers and you're the only person who could see them, would this be okay? And if they say, yeah, I love these flowers. If people see them, it makes them happy. Great. But I just love the process of gardening. I think we're in good shape. It's the process. And so we have to dig deeper.
But as you say, it's not the narcissist who shows up in your office. It's the person they're in a relationship with who shows up.
Typically. I mean, to have narcissistic people shown up in my office, yes, many times, because narcissistic people do get into relationships where people leave them and they do have problems at work and they do experience other mental health issues like addiction and depression and anxiety. If they do come into the office, those are the things that bring them into the office, right? Not I'm narcissistic and I'm hurting other people. It's how come everyone in my workplace is mean to me? Why is everyone out to get me? How come my partner is telling me I have to go to therapy if this relationship's going to work? That's so manipulative. So it's that kind of thing, right? So it's often victimized in that sort of narrative. But yes, by and large, people who are in relationships with narcissistic people are much more likely to end up in therapy than the narcissistic people themselves. And so one of the most difficult elements of narcissism is something, the technical term is sort of a lack of self-reflective capacity. There's no self-awareness. There's no sort of digging in. Like I just said, the person decides to become a comedian and a podcaster. Is there a really meaningful sort of look into what is the why here? Why are you doing this? And if the answer really is, because I want people to love me and admire me and laugh at me, I need that. I actually have worked with clients because LA, so you work with people in the industry. And
the one capital of narcissism, right? And on
really
the planet.
And
yeah.
Yeah. No, I would actually say at this point, DC is winning.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. DC is winning. But when people, you know, I had a client say to me, I want to be famous. And I was really trying to get to the core of it. Wanting to be famous in and of itself is not, it does not tell me someone's a narcissist. It's the why. And this client said to me, I said, what is the famous thing for you? Because famous wasn't coming for this person. And the client said, so I'd never be alone and I'd always feel loved. That to me was the ringer. That was the narcissistic piece of it. And also quite sad because that idea of fame would then forever keep people in this person's thrall and people would hang around this person simply because they were famous rather than out of some desire to be with them. So that's more of a narcissistic motivation.
Is that person born with that or do they develop it in their nurture part of their development?
It's almost all nurture. There's a tiny, like I always say, the sort of the sourdough starter of the narcissistic personality is temperament.
The yeast of...
it's the temperament. It's so we're all born with a temperament, and any of us who have contact with people who knew us as very, very, very small children. I always think it's a worthy ask, especially as we get older and we're losing those people, is to say, what kind of kid was I like before the age of 3 is a very good question to ask. And the more kind of wound up, difficult to soothe, almost intense, externalizing, acting out, attention seeking, like little person you have, that's often a seed of temperament because they're kind of born that way. That can get shaped by the environment. So a kid with that slightly more, brittle, difficult, externalizing temperament, when that comes up against an invalidating world, chaos, adversity, neglect, criticism, that kind of thing, those kids might be become more likely to become narcissistic, but it is shaped by the influences around the child and typically their relationships with their primary caregivers, parents, whomever that is.
How does it present in childhood or in the developmental years?
It doesn't present in childhood. I think that talking about personality in childhood, we really are talking about temperament. We're talking about something biological. And the nervous system is really on it's like a volcanic kind of seismic system, moving, changing, shifting until we're about 25. I always say it's like Jell-O, and the Jell-O starts to get a little bit more firm in late adolescence. And then by 25 to 30, we have solid Jell-O that you could sort of flip out of the mold kind of thing. And in all of that time, personality is very much shape-shifting depending on social relationships, societal influences. That's why adolescents seem like they're all over the map. And one day you have this studious adolescent, and then 6 months you have this acting out adolescent. They're sort of finding their path. And then usually somewhere, like I said, between 25 and 30 years old, we see a personality that's usually going to persist well into throughout the lifespan. So what we see is the temperament coming out in the kid. And that's what I'm saying. There's some kids out there that are really just sort of these very sometimes demanding balls of energy. They're not bad kids, but they're not often funneled in the right direction. Like these are kids who often love sports and having places to play outside and having organized activities in a way that they'd feel seen in all of that kind of moving around and physicality. But that kid is sometimes often, and I think all children feel a need to be seen. There are just some kids who are better self-regulators and almost what we call internalizers. That's not always good either. Because if the internalizing child isn't seen, they might be more likely to become anxious and turn inward and never share those feelings. And so kids need safe, consistent, responsive, attuned environments. Doesn't matter what their temperament is, they're going to get shaped. If you were to go backwards, though, you might see a kid who is more selfish with their possessions and in their play, more likely to be bullying and dominating of other children, who is more likely to be bullying and dominating of siblings, more competitive with siblings, evidence more jealousy, more dysregulated mood states, more potentially disruptive. But again, one of the challenges you have is as I talk about that disruptive stuff, now you're talking more about a kid who might look like they have ADHD, right? Mm-hmm. But ADHD in adulthood is highly correlated with narcissism. Oh, so it's like you can see some of these interplays kind of happening. And many, I'd say if not 90% of adult narcissistic clients I've worked with had co-occurring ADHD. That was a big problem.
Why is that?
I think, here's my hypothesis, and I'm spitballing this one right for you right now.
You will not be held to this legally or morally, so no, please spitball
what
away.
What I think it is, hypothetically, what I really think it is that I think that the child with ADHD, if that to the degree that's happening, again, it's part of a temperamental process, and obviously it's a central nervous system process, but if that's already evolving at early into middle childhood, this is a kid that's constantly being told there's something wrong with them. Sit down, stop that. Why are you such a handful? They're being sent to the principal's office. They're chronically getting in trouble. So I think that these are children who are having a bunch of very invalidating experiences. They often don't do as well in school, so they might feel a sense of shame about that. So all of those psychological dynamics for being invalidated about their ADHD, I think can be a real setup going into an adult narcissism.
Doesn't understand me. I don't have a place.
Yeah. I think ADHD obviously is a true neurodivergence. And so that neurodivergence is not always, it's not orderly, right? It throws teachers off. It throws coaches off. It throws parents off, especially a parent who has multiple children and may, for example, not have the resources or support they need. One kid who is just sort of popping up and needing, that's the kid who's going to hear, stop that, shut up, sit down. That over a whole childhood is a lot of invalidation. And then they're not doing well in school and all. It becomes a really big knot to unwind. And these are kids who might be more likely to self-medicate with substances into adolescence. That becomes sort of part of the whole narcissism circumplex. And so it becomes difficult to tease out. And then what happens is they get into adulthood, it does get messy. I'm like, okay, I've got someone here who's got addiction, they've got ADHD, and then they got something else going on that's making them really difficult. We'll treat the addiction, we might even treat the ADHD, but then we're still left at the trunk of the tree, which is narcissism. So we're still dealing with a difficult person.
You mentioned the family, and in the book you talk about the different roles that evolve in a narcissistic-based family. Can you share some of those, who pops up to accommodate for the narcissistic personality?
So in a healthy family, we don't need roles because the children are attuned to as they are, their authentic selves, rather than feeling that they have to take on roles to remain safe in the system. So narcissistic family systems, though, are all entirely organized around that narcissistic parent or parents. It's really about appeasing, soothing, trying to win over, and trying to sort of stay psychologically safe in the presence of that parent. And as a result of that, especially when there's multiple siblings in a family, kids find themselves almost in these different roles. The two most common roles are the golden child, which is sort of the child that is the heir apparent, the child who might resemble the narcissistic parent or give the narcissistic parent the supply they want. Maybe they're very good at a sport. Maybe they praise the parent a lot. Maybe they resemble the parent, or maybe they were the firstborn son, whatever matters culturally. So that golden child in many ways kind of gets the best of the narcissistic parent, but it's not all good for the golden child who's sort of on what I call the sort of perilous pedestal where they can get, they know darn well that this is a transaction.
So this is the Indian son who has to be a doctor, the Jewish son who's got to be a lawyer, that kind of thing. Culture is interwoven with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. But you can see it in any culture. And the fact is, though, like I said, it's not easy street, because that golden child might think, okay, I'm getting the goodies, but the minute I don't do what this person wants, they go away. So there's a real conditionality to it.
They have to suppress maybe what they want.
Yep. What they want, who they are, what they feel, all of that. Then you have the scapegoat. Now, the scapegoat gets the worst of the narcissistic person. They'll get the abuse. They might give you, and it's so sad for them, because the scapegoated child is often disproportionately abused compared to their other siblings. Like criticism will be heaped on them that is not heaped on their siblings. They will be compared unfavorably to their siblings. It might even almost be the narcissistic parent almost encourages the whole family to pile on, like the scapegoat becomes the big family joke. And it's actually quite heartbreaking. If the scapegoating is severe enough, some of these kids can look like they have complex trauma as they come into adulthood. It's not a pretty picture. And so the scapegoated child may not look the way the parent wants, may not do the things the way the parent wants. Maybe, for example, let's say it's a narcissistic step parent and the scapegoated child is from a prior relationship of the person they got into a relationship. There can be any number of things happening, but for whatever reason, that scapegoated child is either a reminder of something that's bringing shame to that narcissistic parent, or they're not delivering supply in the right way or whatever. Then you have a bunch of other roles, like the fixer. This is the kid that's always like jumping around, trying to like do everything for everyone, like making sure the dishes are clean, making sure everything's okay. It's almost like they're appeasing through doing. They're just making sure everything's okay. Oftentimes, if it's a setup where there's a narcissistic parent and a not narcissistic parent, the fixer will just sort of make sure everything is getting done so as to appease the narcissistic parent. The peacekeeper is sort of a similar role in the sense of the peacekeeper is almost acting as a diplomat, like, oh, no, they didn't make that. They can feel like a rodeo clown, like always trying to make jokes to ease the tension. There is the invisible child. This is a kid that's almost forgotten. In some ways, it's almost like a child who might have such a quiet internalizing temperament has recognized probably at some level no needs are going to be met here. They might come later in birth order. They may have a temperament that no one's taking note of, but there's a sort of overlooking of this child and their needs, because they're not being abused like the scapegoat. They're not being, celebrated like the golden child, and they're not doing things like the fixer or peacekeeper. And then there's this role, and I think it's a role that any one of these other roles could take, which I call sort of the truth seer or the truth teller. This is the kid who gets it. They may not be able to say it at the age of 5, I think my mother's narcissistic, but they kind of see, it's as though they have this knowing. Like, I wish I could almost, it's hard to put into words, but it's as though even at a very young age, they're looking at the situation and somebody watching that child's face, it's like this almost strangely adult, like kind of, they get what's going on. Like they know that this isn't cool. And what's fascinating is narcissistic people, adults, are very socially perceptive. You could put them in a room of 100 people and they could figure out the one person who doesn't approve of them or doesn't want to give them supply. A narcissistic parent is no different. When the narcissistic parent almost detects at some sort of sub-process level that one of their kids is, if you will, kind of judging them, that truth-seeing kid can easily be transformed into a scapegoat.
So either your kid knows you're narcissistic or you have teenagers, because that's what I found with my kids is all of a sudden as teenagers, they see everything. They know the world around them.
They think they know everything too much, having just survived adolescence or still going through it with one of mine. And I think adolescence is an interesting time, right? Because now the adolescent child is kind of really coming into their own and really exerting their will, because that's what you do during adolescence. And you can imagine that will put them at war with many a narcissistic parent when we have to recognize that adolescent kids shit the nest. That's what makes it easier for them, for all of us when they leave.
Yeah.
But for a narcissistic parent, narcissistic parents are very thin-skinned and they tend to personalize what their kids do. So a kid just being a kid, I don't know, spilling a box of Legos or fighting with their siblings, normal things kids do, the narcissistic parent will feel this is targeted at them, which is why narcissistic parents are also more likely to be abusive.
You mentioned some of the myths we have about narcissism. Are most narcissists men?
So it depends on what type of narcissism we're talking about. Grandiose narcissists, more likely to be men. Malignant narcissists, more likely.
By the way, delusional grandiosity is a concept that you mentioned in your book, and I think it might be the new name of our podcast. I think it's a fantastic name.
Their grandiosity is delusional. I do think that.
So grandiose narcissists tend to be men. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, grandiose narcissists, the sort of arrogant, preening, pretentious, look at me, I'm so great, I'm so smart, attention hog, narcissistic folks, those tend to be men. Malignant narcissists, the more menacing, coercive, severely manipulative, isolating, exploitative narcissists, those are more likely to be men. Vulnerable narcissists, victimized, sullen, resentful, passive-aggressive, woe-is-me narcissistic folks, equally distributed between men and women. Mm. So the type of narcissism matters. In the macro, more likely to be men, but that doesn't mean women can't be narcissists. They are, and many people have narcissistic moms. Right there, there's your answer. There are many narcissistic women. I have worked with many men in heterosexual relationships with women, and it was every bit as bad as it was for anyone in any narcissistic relationship. So absolutely, this can happen in women. And I have to say that part of this is societal. Women kind of are like, that concept of arrogance and bragging, by and large at a societal level, is discouraged in women. You're drawing too much attention to yourself. It's considered bad form. But when we think of sort of how boys are raised, there's a bit more of, yeah, go out there, be competitive. And so partly this is a differential socialization, but that vulnerable narcissism, which actually can do a lot of harm in relationships, is equal. It's between genders.
You're just talking about the different kinds of narcissism, and this was really enlightening. Grandiosity, malignant, neglectful, and these were interesting too. Self-righteous and communal. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about those kinds of narcissists and how they present?
The communal narcissist is actually an interesting one. There's research done by a guy named Gebauer and his colleagues in Germany. And when I remember reading it, it was about 20 years ago. It was fantastic work because it captured something we hadn't really adequately captured in this space. Most narcissistic people get their supply by being very self-centered. Me, me, me. Look at me. I'm doing for me. The communal narcissistic person, though, gets their narcissistic supply through this sort of casting themselves as a savior, as a savior of the world, as a grand humanitarian. They're sort of better. They're like a hero. They sort of cast themselves as a hero and will often do hero-ish seeming things, volunteering and doing all kinds of humanitarian gestures or giving money to great causes, but they're doing it to get attention. It's not, again, we're back to process, right? They're not doing it because they're like, this is the work of my heart. I'm going to put myself into it. There are people out there who give billions of dollars away and we don't know about it. Probably not communal narcissists, but the people who every time they do it, it's 70,000 news flashes and I'm in my gala gown and my dripping with diamonds. Doesn't really add up, does it? Or look at me, I'm rescuing everyone on the beach and elephants and I really look hot in my bikini, don't I? So that's a little bit of the communal narcissism model. And the thing with communal narcissism is they remain narcissistic. So people close to them, their family, their partners, maybe even the people who work for them will say, this is not a nice person. And so people who are close in like that continue to endure their abuse. But the image that this person puts out to the world is of humanitarian. So it's actually very confusing for people in these relationships who are with a person who is being thought of as being wonderful by the world, yet the people closest to them are suffering. It often makes it harder for those people to get help. The best example is someone lives in a small town. Their parent is like the small town mayor and the small town little league coach and all this stuff. And their name is on the field. And that parent is a terrible human being to their family. Yet everyone thinks of that person as a pillar of the community. And that takes us to the self-righteous narcissistic folks. This is an interesting sort of departure from some of the classical presentations of narcissism. But this is somebody who is very sort of morally rigid. They are very judgmental, very contemptuous of other people. They don't feel are living in the right way. There's a sort of a holy roller vibe to them.
The piousness, the Pharisees that we've read about.
Yeah, but pious, like, and it's a piousness that sort of supersedes religion. It's I live better than you. I made better choices than you. And if you don't do things the way I do them, which is absolutely right, I will judge you. Self-righteous, narcissistic people tend to be very miserly and very judgmental. Let's say it's a family where there's a self-righteous narcissist who's been very, you know, like particular about how they live and all that, and they save their money. And someone in the family, just through a series of bad luck, get into a car accident, lose a job, whatever, they're down on their luck and they need a little financial support. The self-righteous narcissist may not give it to them, saying, well, you've made bad choices, when in fact they were just rear-ended in a car accident, or will say, I'll loan it to you at some extortionate rate of interest. And then the self-righteous narcissistic folks, they tend to be sort of workaholic-y. They tend to work all the time, and they view that as sort of a moral high ground and very dismissive of anyone who doesn't make choices like their own. And it's like, and very even funny about things like time. They might invite you to a dinner at 6 o'clock, your kid's sick, the babysitter's late. You're like, hey, I'm texting, I'll be there at 6:20. You'll get there at 6:20. They'll say, yeah, we said dinner was at 6 and now there's no more dinner for you, kind of thing. And they'll just shut the door. Like, it's I'm being a bit extreme. You might go out to them and they'll say, well, we have to split the check because you got larger order of French fries. So that was $1 more. And you'll be sitting there with like this sort of in this Venmo hell. And you're like, you know what? I'll pay for everything. That's very much you see in the self-righteous narcissism, but there's still a lack of empathy, an entitlement, a grandiosity. I live better than the rest of you, kind of thing. And so people who've grown up like this will also say it was very controlled. You lived in fear of one thing being out of place. Like, they're very orderly and rigid. Like, I wake up at 4 a.m. to do my vegan goat milk cleanse. And then at 4:20, I'm going to do 2 hours of meditation. And then at 6:20, my trainer's going to come and I expect never to be interrupted. And everything needs to be gray and exactly where it's supposed to be.
And meanwhile, they're posting all this on social media, right?
Of course, starting at 4 a.m. when the rest of us are doing what we're supposed to do, which is called sleep.
So you can see for each of these types of narcissism, how social media just throws gasoline on that spark, or more yeast on the starter portion, because, you know, you look at the grandiosity. Well, what is, you know, social media is a great platform to talk about yourself and say how big you are. Malignant, you can talk shit about other people. The self-righteous or communal people can be out there virtue signaling. Look how great I am about what I do or what I believe, either on the right or the left. But you can see how each of these things is just social media just gives the opportunity to just blow it all up. Like, have you seen changes in the way narcissists appear in the last, since 2005, I guess?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A colleague and friend of mine, a guy named Dr. Keith Campbell at University of Georgia, he's focused much on the narcissism piece, right? Whereas I focused on the survivor side piece. But
yes,
we've talked together and the landscape has changed. I always tell folks this anecdote. It was around whenever it was, 2007, 2008. My kids were little at the time. And I was working late at night and somebody said, have you checked out this Facebook thing? And I'm old enough that a Facebook was the photos they'd give us freshman year. So we knew who our peers were in school.
Right.
That's the term I came up. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I had already started doing my research on narcissism about 8 years before. And they said, no, you got to check this out, you know, sign up for it, whatever. And I did. And I'll never forget the feeling in my stomach. It sank. And I'm like, oh my God, this thing is about to get really bad, because it used to be for a narcissistic person to get validation, they actually had to kind of get dressed up and leave the house. Who's going to come into your house and validate you, right?
Right.
So
right.
Maybe, or they got their supply only from their close system, their family members, which meant they were just, you know, very dominating over that system. They'd have to go to work though. Now I was like, these people could lay in their bed and get validated. So I remember thinking, this is going to be a disaster. It's been a bit of a disaster. And so here's what's interesting. Narcissism has been around since there have been people. Open a history book. Everyone the history books are written about are pretty much, with maybe about 5 to 10% exceptions, narcissistic, right? All these warriors and invaders, they're all narcissists, right? We don't read about the sweet little baker who lived for 50 years in a small town. Nobody reads about that person. We read about the people who made the history, who tend to be narcissistic. It's always been a thing. Now, the thing was, though, grandiose narcissism's also been a thing, the impresario and all of that. One thing that Keith and I sort of agreed very much on, the grandiose narcissism, whatever, it's the vulnerable narcissism that I think where social media has had an effect, because most people don't understand vulnerable narcissism. I think that's the money shot here, because you have this big group of aggrieved, angry. Why did life pass me by? Failure to launch. Angry, angry, passive aggressive, angry, victim, victim, victim. This group has proliferated like some sort of parasitic plague online. Every internet troll is a vulnerable narcissist. Everyone who spouts the stuff so hateful that I can't even look at it anymore, these are the vulnerable narcissists. And this has really become this rather pathological playground for them. Grandiose narcissistic folks, certainly, I think that they've just found a different tool to do what they've always done. But the vulnerable narcissist, this is a tool they couldn't have ever dreamed of. Back in the day, to get a letter in the paper, you had to write it to the editor and you had to type it and the stamp and the envelope. And the editor could have said, this is insane. I am not printing this, right? Now these people can write anything like this all the time. I think that's the problem that's gotten out of control. And we've seen it. The world is a less safe place than it's ever been. A lot of the dysregulated kind of stuff we're seeing that's causing harm, I think that that's what social media has done that's harmful. And it's not quite the person's like, look at me, here's my selfie. There's something ridiculous about a 45-year-old that needs to pose with their abs and their breakfast. But to me, that's just ridiculous. And if somebody can't see that as ridiculous, then that's on you. But the subtle, vulnerable stuff, nobody's been taught that. And as a result, that harm has percolated to the point where I actually think it's bringing the entire global political system down quite a bit.
Yeah. Tell me more about that. Like, where do you see that becoming the most dangerous?
Social media being a place where people who have an axe to grind, shifting how policy is being made, how public offices are being filled. And I don't just mean in the United States. I mean around the world, the way propaganda is shared to, and this can cause problems in terms of how policy decisions are made, how public health decisions are made. I mean, you have enough of people, and there's a lot of people who feel that life has been unfair to them. And when you have people sharing, people in a position of power, sharing a narrative that almost inflames that, they may not even believe it, the people sharing that narrative, but they want those votes, or they want that support, or they want whatever that is from that group. I do think we've created a destabilization in the world. And I think that especially in young people, even when we have conversations about social media is bad for young people, it's more subtle than that. We know a lot of young people coexist with social media just fine, but there is a vulnerable subgroup and they're often preyed upon by that vulnerable narcissistic subgroup.
This calls to mind the topic of gaslighting that happens on both a personal and at a societal level. Can you talk a little bit more about how that shows up?
What's funny, when we talk about it at both levels, I'd say societal gaslighting in a strange way, it has exactly the same effects, but we may not interpret it in the same way because it's involving a whole system. So gaslighting in and of itself is a tactic that is used to destabilize people so you can overpower them, right? If I'm second guessing and doubting myself, you're going to be able to get in there and clip my wallet.
So let's role play. Right? You gaslight me about something.
Okay. So let's pretend we're in a relationship together. Let's use a simple example. We're in a relationship together and you've been coming home late a lot and you're kind of doing something shady and you're kind of like, you need a lot of validation because you're sort of flirty with these people you work with and you go out after work with them, but you don't tell me. And I'm saying you're late. So I'm like, I'd say something like, hey, what's the deal here? Like, you're coming home later and later. Like, what's the story here? You would say to me, if you're gaslighting me, do you know what you're
doing? I would say something like, I'm doing this for you.
Great. Perfect.
I'm doing this for you. And for you to sit here and say that I'm working 80 hours a week to try to provide you with this silly luxuries that you want, and you're questioning my fidelity. Meanwhile, I know about your ex-boyfriend who you're talking to on Facebook.
Perfect. You're perfect.
Who's really cheating here?
Bingo. So do you see, and you did beautifully here. In fact, you're really good at that.
This is totally fabricated.
But what you did great here was you didn't even address the initial issue. We're not even clear that you know you're late. You didn't have to, you just went right in to dismantle me, right? And so if I want to be connected to you, we have a long relationship and I want to be in a relationship with you, then you've been gaslighting me for a while. I'm already a little destabilized. I am doubting myself. I may not want to end the relationship with you, but I want you to come home on time and I don't want you to do these things. That's what I want. Well, that's not on the menu. So you've now further destabilized me. Now, if a person doesn't know what gaslighting is, I might try to, no. I appreciate everything you do. Don't get me wrong. I love everything you do. Like, it's not that, but like, I just want you home. I just want you to be home with me. And now you're angry.
Well, that's a little selfish of you, isn't it?
Bingo.
It's about you. It's about you. Yep. When am I supposed to exercise, by the way?
That's it.
Do you want me to die of a heart attack?
You're so good at this. We could do a roadshow.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
So you see what you've done now. And you've actually integrated something that's actually called DARVO, Dr. Jennifer Fried's model, which is deny, attack, and reverse victim and offender. That's what gaslighting often does entail, which is you've kind of denied you're doing anything. You've attacked me for being greedy and selfish and taking advantage of you. And you've reversed the roles of victim and offender. Now you're the victim and I'm the problem. Right. So now I am so confused. And so I am now begging you, please, please, please. No. Okay. I get it. You have to work late. Now I'm giving you permission to work late. Now I'm almost complicit in my own abuse. And so that doesn't happen once. That happens 100 times. So when this keeps happening in a relationship, the person in a gaslighted narcissistic relationship doubts themselves, believes they're the problem, blames themselves, loses all sense of intuition and direction, and actually starts to view themselves as a bad person. In my work with survivors, the biggest thing I have to dismantle is survivors thinking, I think I'm a bad person with zero evidence. They're actually the loveliest people I've ever met, but they've been told things like you just said to me. Now that's at the individual level. Take this to a big level, right? So let's even go to a, not society, but even workplace. Your workplace has cut 50% of the, what do you call it, the workforce, and the roles and responsibilities haven't changed. So now the people who remain are doing twice as much work because half the people are gone, but the demands haven't changed. And management will say, and everyone, people are saying, we can't keep up. Like, we're now bringing risk to whoever, our clients, our patients, our students, whoever you're working with. Like, we don't have the same quality controls. And the management or the leadership or the C-suite will say something like, well, I guess you're not really committed to the job. I guess you really don't care about our consumers if you're not willing to put in the extra effort, because we're a family here. This is a family.
Right.
This ain't no damn family. You give me a paycheck. And right. So it is a family. And so they use language like family, and we're a team. We're in this together. No, I am not invited to spend the weekend on your yacht, CEO man, who is telling me to work harder on what is not enough money. And so they'll shame the workforce when they cut resources, telling the workforce that they're not committed, all hands on deck, these are hard times, they're taking no pay cuts, and everyone's suffering. Another example of gaslighting, because the people who work there, who may actually be committed to the mission and vision of the job, might say, maybe I'm a bad person for not doing this extra bit. I remember during COVID, the number of nurses I saw gaslighted, who usually had, for example, per union, maybe 3 or 4 patients on their shift, on their 12 hours, were getting 5 and 6. And the nurses were saying, we can't take adequate care of these patients. And the hospitals say, this is an emergency. You need to step up. Don't you care? And many nurses became severely depressed. They were experiencing moral injury. They suffered so much. Many left the field because they were so gaslighted and being told in one of the most perilous times in our collective history that they weren't being good enough because management would not recognize that they'd put them in an impossible situation and offer them supports, money, whatever they needed to be able to get the job done. Now, when we take it to a societal level, this is where we're talking about media that's telling you that look, I'm even going to go in after the wellness industry. How much of the wellness industry says, you know why you're not well? It's your fault because you don't drink enough kale or eat enough this or move enough that. But they leave out the part about people working longer hours than ever, not having adequate support for their families. Like, the world has changed and people are working harder and longer than ever. There's less support for people with families, but then they blame themselves saying, well, the reason I'm not healthy is all my fault. Maybe not. So I think a lot of wellness influencers are guilty of gaslighting, and that has happening on a mass scale. But at the most mass scale of all are governments and media that are actually telling people, in essence, what your perception of the world is wrong. I had a fascinating conversation with someone the other day who said that so much of our news is doom and gloom and doom and gloom. And we're all convinced that an asteroid's going to hit the Earth tomorrow because it's all terrible. But actually, there's a particular case. He was talking about climate change. And he's like, We've actually made some interesting strides in these spaces too, in many spaces, but we only hear the bad news. We don't hear where, you know, certain, we don't hear that certain public, you know, public endeavors are actually working. We only hear things are bad. And what that's done, it's also resulted in a collective sense of helplessness. Everyone feels incompetent, like I can't change the world. And that's creating a depression, but the media never reports the stuff that's working.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
that's, and you know, all that's a gaslighting as well. So all of these things together are happening at the societal level, at the institutional level, at the family level, and at the individual level. So we all kind of feel like we're losing our minds. We're all in a relationship with the narcissist. It's basically the world at large.
The behaviors of narcissists are fascinating and you see them everywhere, but your book is really intended for the people who are in relationships with narcissists. This is a gift to those people. And so I want to serve those people because they're probably sitting there going like, I think this book is for me. Let's talk a little bit more about them. How do you know if you're in a relationship with a narcissist? What questions are you asking yourself when you're looking in the mirror?
Is it me? What's wrong with me? Maybe I need to be better. I wish I could get it right. Is there a different way I could say it? I mean, am I a bad person? Maybe I'm narcissistic. Do I gaslight people? There's this constant destabilization, this constant questioning of self. And what you have to remember, there's a core assumption here that I think we all forget about. In healthy human beings, the need for affiliation, attunement, connection, love, and psychological safety is once we get food, water, and air and shelter out of the way, that's it. And that is a very healthy thing to want to be close and connected to other human beings. So when someone's been in our life and we love them and we have a history with them, whether it's a partner, whether it's a family member, we're not about to dismantle that because they gaslighted us. We're going to try to find ways to make it work because we don't know what it is we're dealing with. But as this happens, a pattern is accumulating. But the more, and I always tell people, look for the dichotomies in your life. Because if you have a group of people that are healthy and really enjoy you, who are like, I love seeing you. Like, this is so fun talking with you. And they're the same group of people. And yet there's these other, and probably not as many, there's a few people in your life where you always feel incompetent, foolish, stupid, worthless. Take a look at that dichotomy. I don't think that that group that's telling you that you're nice, unless you're giving them a lot of money, that they're healthy people.
You're the same person, right?
Same person. And so the understanding that, because it takes people a minute, but the problem is to see this pattern opens up a really ugly portal. And that's a portal into, oh my gosh, I'm in a really unhealthy relationship. That is never going to change.
Because the narcissist isn't going to change.
They're not going to change it. This is a very rigid personality style that's very maladaptive, but it's working for them and they don't have insight into it. By and large, when you call a narcissistic person out on their behavior, they're going to blame you. This is exactly what you did in the gaslighting sequence. This is your fault. This, yeah. I didn't say that. You know, you're pushing me too hard. You're unrealistic about what you want in a relationship. So when we get that kind of pushback, we, you know, over and over and over again, they're not taking accountability and they actually believe they're nice people. There's a whole bunch of research that shows that narcissistic people overestimate their positive influence on other people, their levels of empathy, their levels of generosity. Their superficial accessible schema is, I'm a great guy. I'm super cool. I'm fun to be with. People want to be, I'm so nice.
Right. And then the person they're in a relationship with, this person has seduced you. They've turned you on. Maybe you've got children together. Your life looks great on paper because he or she is very successful financially and, you know, a member of the community. And yet you're miserable at home. And there's this dichotomy, as you said, between how it looks on paper and how you feel when you wake up every morning. So what do you do?
So that piece of it, that dichotomy between those two things is something we call cognitive dissonance.
Right.
And cognitive dissonance is this tension that we experience when the pieces don't fit. So for example, someone's in a long-term marriage and it's becoming clear that this is toxic. Well, that doesn't fit because you want to be married to a healthy person. So the thing we want to maintain is what's going to win. And for most people, it's, I want to maintain the relationship. We've got kids, we have a home, we have a life. So they will do what they need to do to make this toxic piece fit. And they will justify it. They will rationalize it. They will blame themselves for it. if there's a lot of betrayal, they might even sort of not quite forget it, but push it away to a part of the brain where it's not kind of seen. And so it is it's sort of denial meets dissonance meets dissociation, kind of a stew. So you can get it out of the way and stay in the relationship. So cognitive dissonance is a big problem in these relationships. Another big problem in these relationships relates to slot machines. They are intermittently rewarding. They're not always bad. And when they're good, they can actually be very good. You might go to Hawaii and have this fun vacation. There's something that, again, that charm and charisma don't die. They're all there. So you might go, you might laugh, you might have great sex, you might have fun. You have these great pictures like, okay, I misjudged this because you got the little bit of a mini jackpot. And then it's all like dollar in, nothing out, dollar in, nothing out, dollar in, nothing out. That goes on for a while. And then there's a tiny bit of a reward.
Yeah.
And that sort of getting some good days and a lot of bad days, that same architecture of a slot machine is exactly what's happening in these relationships.
Which leads to the third R of your three R's, which is euphoric recall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the euphoric recall is, it's strange. We do something very counterintuitive in these relationships. Usually we selectively remember bad stuff. That's evolutionarily selected, right? For remembering bad stuff keeps us safe. Well, for whatever reason, something called trauma bonding, we remember the good stuff in these relationships. I remember once talking to a woman, been married 30 years to an absolutely horrible human being. And I think on like 9 months into their relationship, they went to Miami for this fabulous weekend and went out dancing till 4 a.m. 30 years later, she was still talking about that night in Miami. What's ensued in the 30 since years has been horrible. Betrayal and cheating and financial abuse and everything. But she kept coming back to that night in Miami. Like euphoric recall is that capacity to forgetting all the terrible things but they're attractive but we have so much fun playing Scrabble. And I'm like, how good could someone be at Scrabble? I mean, this person is destroying your soul, but it's when we're trauma bonded, that bond created by good days, bad days, more and more bad days, fewer good days, that's very difficult to break away from. And a lot of it is sort of this narrative schema we've constructed about, I don't want to be wrong about this. What if they do go back to that all night dancing in Miami person? I want that again. That was for show. You know, I mean, it's every day can't be Disneyland. It's just not how life works. But there are these moments that make people feel like there's got to be a way I can keep those moments going. And the answer is no, there's not.
So what do you do?
I'm going to tell you now, it's a painful sequence, right? It's almost like telling somebody to get back surgery. You have to get it, right?
You're the bearer of good news all the time. That must be a joy.
I ultimately am a bearer of good news, but it takes a minute to get there. But first of all, you have to get it. You have to listen to conversations like this. You have to read the first three chapters of the book. You have to know what this is and understand what it is, like that it has a consistency and a structure. There's a reason for this word. Then you have to understand something called radical acceptance. This is not going to change. Radical acceptance doesn't mean you're signing off on it. It doesn't mean you're okay with it. And it doesn't mean it's going to stop hurting. It means it's really not going to change. So whatever decisions you make have to be based in these realistic expectations that this is how it is. I never, ever, ever prescribe a course for people. Leave, go. You have to do what's right for you. But once you open that gateway of radical acceptance, it's sort of like hellishly you go into this grief space because people say, I have lived the last 25 years. I've lived since I was a small child, believing that someday this could get better. There's something I could do. To give that hope up is such a sense of loss and such a sense of grief. It is like a tidal wave overtaking people. That's the hardest part for me as a therapist, is to hold on tight to the client and say, we're going to get to the other side of this, but you've got to feel this out. Like you have to experience this as a loss. Because when we get to the other side of this grief, and human beings are remarkable, we always get to the other side of the grief. Then it's about the disengagement. And something I tell folks is healing from a broken heart, while painful, is actually child's play compared to healing from somebody making you feel crazy. Shrinks have a great advantage. In 6 weeks, everyone heals from a broken heart. There might be a little bit of yearning, and social media might push it out to 12 weeks. But
thanks,
time
Facebook.
Is our friend. Yeah. Time is our friend with broken hearts. Time is not our friend with feeling crazy. You really have to get in there and address it. And it's the uncrazying that's the hardest part. So during the grief stage, it's a lot of the broken heart, the loss of hope, the loss of the narrative, the loss of the stories you were telling yourself about all of this. Then as you come out of that, you see a little bit more anger. And I love me some anger because that's motivating. Now we're starting the uncrazy you phase. And that's helping people see the patterns and say, oh, there we go. I'm being gaslighted and I'm going to disengage this time instead of getting into it with them. I use techniques. I tell people don't go deep, which means don't defend, don't engage, don't explain, and don't personalize. Don't get in the mud with them anymore. They want your argument. That's power for them. So don't get into it. Disengage. Even if you stay in the relationship, you can stick to sort of sports, news, weather. And these days you can't even talk about news. So sports and weather. Like you can say, can you believe they opened a new Starbucks? I hear it's going to rain. It's going to be a hot summer. Like that's kind of all you got. Some people, I say, put the topics in your phone. Talk about them. That helps because they can talk about themselves endlessly. But they're going to keep hitting it, trying to reach in there and get the fight out of you. Just talking to someone this morning, actually, who was the hardest part of about this particular person's situation related to narcissistic abuse is that in her case, she's co-parenting. So this person is just unrelenting with the vulnerable narcissistic victimization and manipulation. And she said, I get it. I even know how to respond now. I don't get in the mud with him, but it's unrelenting. And she's like, it's like living in a constant state of vigilance. And that can wear you down. So it's important to do things like develop healthy social supports, get into therapy, find support groups, work towards figuring out who you are separate from this narcissist. When we're in these relationships long enough, we become what they want us to be.
Right.
And we have to slowly bring our, like, who are you? What kind of topping do you want on your pizza? Where do you like going on vacation? What's your favorite TV show? And a lot of survivors of long-term narcissistic relationships will say, let me get back to you on that because I actually don't know.
Wow.
And that's the healing piece. That's the, you know what? I like sleeping with the thermostat set at 63. I happen to like reality TV and I want some damn pineapple on my pizza. And I'm getting it from the place I want and not the place they wanted. And you take yourself back in these little ways, superficial and small, big and deep. You find those places where you can be you. And yes, a lot of people have regret about this relationship. All of us will have some regret, but there's also something profound that happens. It actually sometimes forces people to go deeper into this authentic space because once you learn what it is, you can pull away. You become more discerning. You're able to potentially avoid this happening to you again in the future because you are going to meet more narcissistic people. And then again, give yourself, and then get away from constant survival mode. Survival's messy. Thriving is very elegant and beautiful. And so you're not always on the defense, but actually can start living in a more intentional way, even if you're still in contact with the narcissistic person. I know it can happen. I see it happen every day. Every day, I hear more extraordinary people extraordinarily, I should say, pulling themselves out of these messes and finally living as themselves. But my goodness, they had to make sacrifices. Pulling away from families, ending long-term relationships, losing friendships. I'm not saying any of this is easy,
right.
But there is another side. It's a long walk.
Somebody said to me when I was having relationship problems as a younger person, they said, drama is optional. And I really took that to heart. That doesn't mean there's never going to be any drama in a relationship, but extraordinary drama, I believe, is something that you can avoid if you're very purposeful about it. So if any of this sounds familiar to any of my listeners that have stayed all the way through this fascinating conversation, I highly recommend that you read Dr. Romani's new book, It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. I learned a lot. It's fascinating just to read, to learn about narcissism. But if you find yourself in this relationship, you've got to read this book. You've got to get the help because there is a way out. Dr. Romani, thank you so much for your work and for taking
thank
the time
so
to
much.
Join us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's jump into some takeaways. Number one, I think in Dr. Romani, what you see here is a person who knows her purpose and works very hard to create the most value for the people who will benefit from her purpose. And those are people who are in relationships with people who have narcissistic personality disorder and to help them recognize it and find a way either out of it or to make the most of it. That is an underserved population. So if you know a person who is in a relationship like the ones she described, please refer them to her work so that they can benefit from her insights and they can feel less crazy about themselves eventually because they'll at least say, oh, that's what's going on. Because, you know, we didn't talk about this stuff 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And a lot of people are from homes where it's not discussed culturally. Whether it's, you know, some of the cultures that we mentioned or conservative South or whatever, that, you know, you don't have a lot of explicit discussion of mental disorders like this one. And as I'm reading this book, I found myself thinking, I know that guy, or I was in a relationship with a woman like that. or at my worst, I demonstrated some of this behavior. And so I just think Dr. Ramani's work is really powerful and can help a lot of people. So definitely share the good news that she's put together. And this book, as I mentioned, is just a gift for people who will benefit from it. Secondly, social media. I don't know what to say. Obviously, I worked at Facebook and benefited greatly from it. And I still believe that the power of the connections that Facebook has created have improved my life in a lot of ways, that I'm in touch with people that I love, that I care about because of Facebook, because of Twitter, because of Instagram, whatever. But it's undeniable that the incentives of these social networks, the incentives they create for the users to create a big following or to just get the brain feelies back from putting up a certain kind of post, that these are doing irreparable damage and maybe distracting us from the kinds of work we should be doing with our life as opposed to just putting the camera in our face and say, look at me. I don't know what to say about that. I don't see it getting any better anytime soon, unfortunately. Maybe the best we can do right now is to think about the things we talked about in this conversation and say, oh, I see that person. What they're demonstrating is either grandiosity or self-righteousness or whatever. And so maybe we can benefit from just being aware about what's going on. Speaking of which, gaslighting is maybe one of the most powerful tools that is being used at a political level and being used on social media and Facebook all the time. And that the more we can understand what it looks like, the more we can protect ourselves from people that will use it against us. And I'm talking here mostly about broader political movements, whether you're on the right or the left, you're being gaslit constantly when politicians or journalists or movements tell you that what you are processing through your eyes and your ears isn't correct. They're trying to gaslight. They are gaslighting you to make you feel crazy when they're doing something that is important and they're trying to distract you from it. The Google Gemini disaster. Oh, nothing going on there. Oh, you're making it up. It's not an issue. It's not a real, of course it's an issue. It's a giant issue. And what's behind it is a very dangerous political movement. For people to try to tell you that it doesn't matter is insulting to your intelligence and to your sanity. And there's plenty of examples of that on the other side of the aisle as well. I just don't have them in mind right now. That is the most recent and most egregious in my mind, coming from an organization that controls more data than any other organization in the history of planet Earth. So keep an eye out. When people are bullshitting you, when people are lying to you and trying to make you feel crazy and trying to make you feel dumb because you don't know, you're not smart enough to interpret the news the way we are, raise a red flag. Call bullshit. All right, that's it. Thanks for sticking around. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. We'll be back next week. See ya.